Welcome to Piedmont Arts. I'm Rachel Stewart. As we celebrate the 250th anniversary of America this week, we've got two conversations that explore different aspects of the American experience, one past and one present. We'll learn about the music of the Moravians, who settled in colonial North Carolina and Pennsylvania. And we'll find out about an opera that's being produced by Brevard Music Center this summer. It tells the story of a military family's service and sacrifice in contemporary times. In the 1760s, a traveler in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, was so surprised by the quality of the music he heard there, he described it as Vienna in the wilderness. He was speaking of the Moravians, one of the oldest groups of Protestants, with roots in what is now the Czech Republic. They emigrated to America, particularly Pennsylvania and North Carolina, in the mid-18th century, and their contributions to American music are significant, if not widely known. WDAV's Mylita Melton has researched and produced a special program airing the 4th of July weekend called Vienna in the Wilderness, The Moravian Sound, and I hope you'll be able to listen to it. As she was putting the show together, she sat down with Moravian music expert Dr. Christopher Ogburn, executive director and staff musicologist of the Moravian Music Foundation. They talked about some of the significant players in the musical life of the Moravians, including composer John Antes, who wrote some of the earliest chamber music in North America, composer Johann Friedrich Peter, whose Psalm of Joy was performed as part of the first Independence Day celebration, and organ builder David Tannenberg. Here's their conversation.
I love the philosophy that music was essential to life and built character.
It's part of that 18th century German idea, the Bildung, the notion that you are kind of elevating yourself. And through elevating kind of your aesthetic sensibilities, you're also elevating your spiritual sensibilities.
A lot of people are really surprised to learn how sophisticated Moravian music collections are. What kind of works and composers are preserved at the Moravian Music Foundation's archive in Old Salem?
Kind of think of any composer from the mid-18th century up through the beginning of the 19th. They are probably represented in the Moravian collections. We have some of the more well-known composers like Haydn. There's a number of Haydn's string quartets and symphonies that are in the collections. We have one of the earliest copies of Haydn's string quartet number 17, for instance. But then we also have his last string quartets, Mozart symphonies, Mozart string quartets. And then we have some rarer works on J.C.F. Bach, one of Johann Sebastian Bach's sons. We have four of his sinfonias that are the only copies in the entire world. So if it was not for the Moravians having hand-copied those and preserved them for centuries, that music would have been lost.
Talk about the preservationist aspect of Moravians and why they preserved all this music.
No, it's one of the truisms of Moravians that we don't throw anything away. So they had, from an early era, a library that was dedicated to the music of the community. Sometimes in safe locations, sometimes not so much. We found fairly recently, just a few decades ago, in an organ in Dover, Ohio, a cracker box of music that had been, we thought, lost for generations, and it was magically discovered when they were working on the organ.
What do you think makes Moravian music worth discovering and important to an Independence Day celebration?
Famous names like George Washington and John Adams, Ben Franklin, were coming and seeing and experiencing what the Moravians were doing. But they also had schools, and people attended these schools. And one thing that's not been studied is how the knowledge that was gained in Moravian schools was then spread out. And you have kind of this invisible web of influence that probably had a great impact on the rise of American musical life in the late 18th, early 19th century that's never really been studied and understood.
Let's talk about John Antes, who's so often overlooked.
He, like a lot of Moravians at the time, did not stay put in one place. And this was pretty common. So he's from North America, but very early on in his life went to Europe and studied and did some work in Germany, eventually went to England, and then did some missionary work in Egypt for a number of years.
And was chased by pirates.
Yeah, chased by pirates. He was captured by some Ottoman officials and tortured during his capture. So he really was kind of all over the place.
And somehow he found time to compose.
Exactly. And composed what is considered to be the first string chamber music written by a North American while he was in Egypt. And what's kind of tantalizing is he may have possibly written the first string quartets, but we don't have those anymore with us. We don't know what happened to them. We know they exist. He wrote a letter to Ben Franklin, and in the letter, partly he's kind of advocating for the Moravians because they had been pacifist in the Revolutionary War, and he was arguing for some leniency towards the community. But in that same letter, he mentions that he enclosed a set of string quartets, and that's kind of our clue that they exist, but we don't really know what happened to them.
What a fantastic body of work that he does have between the hymns, the anthems, all the travel, the missionary work. Do you think that his music, especially the chamber works, how do you think they compare to works by Haydn or Mozart?
They're interesting little pieces, and we think Antes may have met Haydn. Haydn has a mention in one of his letters that he had met a dilettante composer. He gets the name a little bit wrong, but it's very close to Antes, so we think it's probably who he's referring to. The music itself, though, it's a little idiosyncratic. The Moravians did not go to formal conservatories. They weren't necessarily going to receive high musical training. They were largely self-taught. And so when you look at the string trios, they're similar in style to what was going on with the other classical composers of the era, like Haydn and Mozart. But there are little twists and turns along the way that someone like Haydn or Mozart maybe would have trained themselves not to do, which kind of adds, I think, a little bit of interest.
Let's go on and talk about Johann Friedrich Peter and the Psalm of Joy. Who was Peter, and what role did he play in the musical life of Old Salem? He did a little bit of everything, too.
He was born in Holland, educated in Germany, and then comes to North America, originally settling in the north in Bethlehem before coming to Salem in 1780. And when he comes to Salem, he basically establishes the musical life of Salem. He starts the Collegium Musicum, the community orchestra. He is the diarist for the community. He is a pastor. He leads the boys' school. He performs the organ. He copies the music. He's the one who started basically the music library in Salem.
Let's talk about Psalm of Joy, which is often cited as one of the earliest extended choral works composed in America. What makes this piece so significant musically and historically? And how did that first concert, July 4th, 1783, really come about? Is it true the governor just happened to ride through and go like, hey, guys, we've decided we're going to celebrate the American Revolution on July 4th. You guys do music. You know, how about it?
Governor Martin at the time, a couple weeks earlier, had gotten notice from the legislature that July 4, 1783, which was going to be the first July 4th after the end of the war, was going to be a day of praise and thanksgiving. So this proclamation was sent out to all the major towns in North Carolina at the time. Salem does not mention in their diary records anything about the proclamation until June 30th. And it's believed, we think, Governor Martin was in town that day. So it's likely that he brought the proclamation with him. But the Moravians had had a very complex history with the new government, with really the Revolutionary War period in general, between both the British and the new American government. They were pacifist, so they did not take up arms on either side, which at the end of the day really resulted in both sides kind of being very suspicious. So when the war was over and this proclamation came out, the Moravians thought, we want to show that we are going to be good citizens. And so we get this proclamation, we're going to do what we do. And they had 4 days, so they put together a full day of celebrations with worship services, with a little parade, and with a musical performance in the middle of the day that was centered around a love feast. And a love feast, it's a very Moravian service in which a simple meal is shared amongst the congregation while music is performed. They performed what is known as the Psalm of Joy. This was a piece that Peter had basically 4 days to put together, so he knew he didn't have time to write a brand new piece. So he starts going through his collections, what he's got available, and he centers on a performance that had taken place 20 years earlier in Germany in 1763 to celebrate the end of the Seven Years' War. And this was a celebration of the end of conflict, which really mirrored what was going on in the United States at that time. So he takes that, changes some of the storyline of it, kind of moves some things around, changes some of the text, some of the hymns that were sung, but basically uses that as its framework. And that's what became the Psalm of Joy, part of what is considered one of the very first official July 4th celebrations. And when you look at the Psalm of Joy overall, it's not a piece about victory. It's not reveling in that at all. It is a piece about peace. It's a piece that is really about the return of the everyday normality of life, that we no longer have to fear and worry about the conflict. And you think about the message of Psalm of Joy, that's really one aspect of it that we can take with us even today, is that joy that can be found in those everyday moments of rest and peace and the end of conflict. We all have, whether it's internationally, nationally, or internally, that sense of unease and conflict within us.
I'm so fascinated by David Tannenberg, his life, his son-in-law, and how he created that amazing instrument.
When we look at instrument building in North America, there are few more important names than David Tannenberg. He was one of the first organ builders in this country. He brought with him, when he came to North America, the traditions of German organ construction. And he designed a number of organs, not just for Moravian settlements like Lititz, Salem, Bethlehem, but also communities outside of the Moravians. In Philadelphia, for instance, there were several organs by Tannenberg. He had a very particular aesthetic sensibility, and it was very Moravian. It's designed to blend into its surroundings. So it's not one of these organs like you would imagine in a giant Baroque cathedral. It's meant to kind of blend in and almost disappear. And for the organ in Moravian music, that's kind of its function as well. It's not a grand virtuosic instrument like you imagine with the Lutheran Church, with Bach, for instance.
The organ was not center stage. Mm-hmm. It was to accompany voices.
Both musically, but also literally. So the organs were often at the back of the congregation in the Saal. So the organ would not even be in the front of the church. It would often be behind the congregation.
And it was tuned a little differently for that reason.
Yes. Well, it was tuned both for that reason, but also historically, because we had not settled on a concert pitch at that point. So it is half a step lower. So the A today sounds lower than the modern A. Choirs love this. This is a challenge with some Moravian music, is it's often very high for the sopranos, but it's actually half a step lower technically because it was being written for an instrument that was not tuned the same way that we're used to singing today.
Now, by the time he completed that organ for Home Moravian Church, he was in his 70s and wasn't able to travel into Salem for the installation. So he sent his son-in-law, who did the original tuning of it, but then didn't teach anyone else how to tune it after he left. I bet that was a little conflict between the two of them.
There are some letters that have survived between the two of them, but also between the congregation and Tannenberg. And there was a lot of tension for him. These organs were his
babies.
And to entrust someone else to travel.
And it took a whole year of your life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you're carting these very sensitive, very fragile pipes all the way from Pennsylvania down to North Carolina. A lot could go wrong along the way.
Well, I'm looking forward to being there on July 4th to hear the Psalm of Joy performed on that massive Tannenberg organ. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
That's WDAV's Mylita Melton talking with Dr. Christopher Ogburn, Executive Director and Staff Musicologist of the Moravian Music Foundation. Johann Friedrich Peter's Psalm of Joy will be performed on the Tannenberg organ you just heard described, and that'll be on July 4th at 3 p.m. in Gray Auditorium at the Old Salem Visitor Center in Winston-Salem. And be sure to tune in to WDAV's special program, Vienna in the Wilderness, produced and hosted by Mylita, on Thursday, July 2nd at 7 p.m., Saturday, July 4th at 4 p.m., and Sunday, July 5th at 1 p.m. Still to come in this episode, a chat with the creators of an opera about how war affects military family life. And next, Phil Vavra will share some ideas of things to do in coming days.
Thanks, Rachel. Well, it's finally here, America's 250th birthday. You won't need any help finding fireworks this weekend, but here are a few other events in the arts and culture realm that you might want to add to your activities list. The 90th summer season at Brevard Music Center continues with more intriguing concerts over the next week. The lineup includes the Brevard Music Center Orchestra and violinist Nancy Zhu performing works by Carlos Simon, Shostakovich, and Brahms at Whittington Fole Auditorium on Friday night, July 3rd. On the 4th of July, Saturday, the Brevard Concert Orchestra and Brevard Symphonic Winds will present an afternoon of patriotic pops with pieces by Ives, Sousa, Tchaikovsky, and some movie music by John Williams. That starts at 2 o'clock. The new Eastern Festival of Music is underway at Guilford College through August 1st. This weekend's offerings include the festival's music director, Gerard Schwartz, leading the gala opening All Orchestrals Night with George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and Antonin Dvorak's Ninth Symphony on Friday, July 3rd. USA at 2:50 will feature works by Copland, Foote, and Gershwin on Saturday, July 4th. And then it's two nights of Eastern Chamber Music on July 6th and 7th. All concerts will be at Dana Auditorium in Greensboro. You can also celebrate our nation's 250th birthday with the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra at Truist Field in Uptown Charlotte on Saturday the 4th. There's no ball game that night. The event will focus purely on music and fireworks, with CSO Music Director Kwame Ryan leading a program of works by John Williams, George Gershwin, and John Philip Sousa. You have two upcoming opportunities to join the historic Salem Band for the Triad's original Stars and Stripes concert. Bring your lawn chairs and blankets to Salem Square in Winston-Salem on Saturday the 4th. The Salem Band will also be at Clemens First Baptist Church on Tuesday, July 7th. The performances are free and will include several marches, big band numbers, and sing-alongs. The Forum Music Series at Lees McRae College welcomes the Western Piedmont Symphony to Hayes Auditorium in Banner Elk for two performances on Monday, July 6th at 5 p.m. and at 7:30. Led by music director Matthew Troy, it'll be an evening of classic American music featuring film scores, patriotic pops, and more. Blumenthal Arts is bringing a bit of Halloween to your summer with Dracula, a comedy of terrors at Booth Playhouse in Charlotte. A new reimagining of Bram Stoker's classic tale, this 90-minute production is filled with hilarious wordplay and pop culture references. It runs July 7th through August 9th. West Market Street United Methodist Church in Greensboro is hosting All the Keys, a diverse concert featuring piano, harpsichord, and pipe organ on Thursday, July 9th at 7 p.m. Admission is free, but donations of dry and wet cat and dog food for pets in need are encouraged. Also coming up, the Whitewater Center 4th of July celebration, the Christmas in July Festival in downtown West Jefferson, and the 50th anniversary South Carolina Peach Festival in Gaffney. Get all the details on those and even more events on my complete fanfare column at WDAV.org. And fanfare is made possible in part by Bragg Financial. Rachel?
Thanks, Phil. Well, it's music festival season in the Carolinas, and Spoleto USA just wrapped up 2 weeks of art and performances in Charleston. Now the Brevard Music Center's Summer Institute and Festival gets underway June 26th. Coming up in July is a modern opera about the rigors of war and how it affects servicemen and women and their families. My colleague Jude Lynn Gibson tells us more.
The opera opens with a soldier recording a birthday greeting for her daughter back home. This character, called Soldier, is a combination of the military men and women composer Zach Redler and librettist Jerry Dye talked to create the opera, The Falling and the Rising. Librettist Jerry Dye explains how it all came together.
Zach and I and one of our amazing cohorts, Ben Hilgert from the United States Army Field Band and Chorus, were invited into some pretty amazing spaces. Fort Meade, Walter Reed Hospital, to interview soldiers and their families about everything from service to coming home to connection and really how they found themselves in the military and what that experience has been like. And then we translated those interviews into words and music.
When it's performed during the Brevard Music Center's Summer Institute and Festival, it'll be the 21st time The Falling and the Rising has been produced. Composer Zach Redler says that's almost unheard of for a new opera, but he thinks it's because of the story and how it came about.
As we were speaking to all of these different people and their family, one interview kind of popped out. We started to think about who might be the main character. We noticed a lack of female soldier representation just in general in terms of the media. So we knew that it was going to focus on this female soldier. She doesn't have a name, so it's a little bit more abstract into, like, could be everybody, you know, like it's she is a mother. That was another story that was relatively less told.
Redler says their conversations with injured service members basically told them how to write the story of this opera, especially what happens to Soldier after she delivers her birthday message.
An explosion goes off and she is rushed into a hospital. She's induced into a coma, also coming from interviews that we did. And one of the things that was really striking about the people that we talked to, who one in particular who was in a coma, who was put in a coma, he lived this whole other life for the 3 months he was in a coma. He was, I think he was 42, married with two kids, living in Hawaii, and he was a 19-year-old kid, you know, and
this was in his coma.
This was during his coma, and it was so fascinating. This soldier, in order to make her way back to her daughter, is going in and out of consciousness, and these other soldier, they're not archetypes because they are, like, they're built on real people, but, like, take her home. And she finds her way home, and there's a, you know, there's a little bit of a question of whether she'll make it. She makes it, spoiler, but, like, it is a happy and very moving ending.
The service members that Soldier meets during her coma journey are all military men and women who are suffering their own forms of grief, loss, and trauma.
We also tried to address the joys of service and that those feelings of connection that every single, the one common denominator that every single soldier spoke about was the connections I made with my battle buddies or the people, you know, the people that I serve with. Were unlike any friendships or connections that I think I've had in my entire life. You look to your right, you look to your left, and we are one.
When Zach Redler and Jerry Dye were approached by the U.S. Army Field Band to compose The Falling and the Rising, they said they had no idea the impact of their work on veterans and civilians who would never attend an opera.
They've been performed in the tiniest little fabulous little cafe gymatoriums and tiny little towns. And it's also been performed in, you know, at the Ailey Theater in New York and at much larger houses. So it's scaled up, scaled down. It's been with a piano. Zach has multiple orchestrations which accommodate different size orchestras, which, again, very rare for an American opera to say, hey, how do we get people that have never seen an opera in to see an opera? That was one of the goals, too. We always thought about this as a first-touch opera experience.
The Venn diagram of, you know, veterans and military families and new opera and small opera companies is not typically an overlap, and I think a lot of these companies saw it as an opportunity to meet new people and to bring people in. And it was really successful. I know, again, a lot of, like, they offered free tickets for veterans and their families. They offered, Opera Carolina offered, they were offering counseling services as well. Like, you know, just in case there were any triggering things, but also just, it was almost like a conference of, there were five or six different tables of different vet organizations there for outreach for the vet organizations too. So I think it's been a really lovely connection of communities that don't overlap often. But another really incredible thing that has come out that we did not foresee is that because we wrote this anthemic finale, companies that weren't working with the Soldiers Chorus started to involve veteran organizations to form vet choruses to come in for, like, this, the last 4 minutes, and they all, and it's just incredible. Like, for Opera Memphis, the oldest was a 92 or 93-year-old Battle of the Bulge survivor. The highest ranking was a 2-star major general. And then the lowest was maybe even ROTC, but like at least private. You know, so it was so incredible. And these soldiers' choruses still exist in Seattle for Seattle Opera, in Bozeman for Opera Montana, and I think a number of other places.
Composer Zach Redler and librettist Jerry Dye. The Falling and the Rising will be performed at Brevard on July 9th and July 11th. For Piedmont Arts, I'm Judlyn Gibson.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of Piedmont Arts. To make sure you get our new episode every week, subscribe to the podcast at wdav.org/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and iHeart Podcasts. Thanks for listening. For Piedmont Arts, I'm Rachel Stewart.